An in-depth look at the engaging debate on US, China, and global issues. This is The Heat.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump was back in a New York courtroom on Monday for the start of his so-called hush money criminal trial. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Attorneys for both the prosecution and the defense delivered their opening statements, and a former publisher took the stand as the first witness. CGTN's Karina Mitchell begins our coverage from New York.
Well, it was the first day of testimony in the criminal trial against Donald Trump, and both sides outlined their cases. Of course, the burden of proof lies with the prosecution. The defense doesn't have to bring any evidence or witnesses. Prosecution went first with opening statements. They're calling this a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up. They said Donald Trump knowingly falsified business records tied to hush money paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels over an alleged dalliance they had. And they say that the hush money was paid, all of this was done to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. In fact, the prosecutor said to the jury, quote, it was election fraud, pure and simple. And he says the motivation for all of this was Donald Trump was worried that if the Stormy Daniels story came out on the eve of the election, that would damage his chances to become president. So he contrived this conspiracy scheme to hide negative stories against him. It was then the defense turn to present their case. They came out and said Donald Trump is innocent, that he had nothing to do with the paperwork tied to the 34 felony counts against him. All he did was sign the checks. And they also said that Michael Cohen, a key witness for the prosecution, cannot be trusted because he's obsessed with Donald Trump and he has a vendetta against him. And then he also turned to the jury and he said, quote, spoiler alert, nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy. He said that Donald Trump was merely trying to protect his family, himself, and his brand when that hush money was paid and an NDA was signed by Stormy Daniels, neither of which, he reminded the jury, is illegal. And looking ahead, there will be a hearing in the Tuesday session. Judge Mershon will make a decision on whether Donald Trump violated a gag order with comments he made last week. The jury then will return with David Pecker taking the stand once again. He was there briefly today. He was a good friend of Donald Trump. He also ran the National Enquirer, which is known to have bought and buried stories that were negative about Trump. He's being called by the prosecution, and he's expected to testify that he helped broker that hush money payment to Stormy Daniels and that he was in a 2015 meeting with Donald Trump himself and Michael Cohen, where they came up with this catch and kill scheme to basically catch negative stories about Donald Trump and bury them. And in exchange for his testimony, he is being given immunity by the prosecution. Karina Mitchell in New York, CGTN.
For more on the Trump criminal trial and the U.S. presidential race, let's turn to our panel. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Rena Shaw. She's a political commentator and CEO of Rylax Strategies. Also with us, Douglas Sloan is principal of National Capital Strategy Group and former vice president of the D.C. chapter of NAACP. From Florida, Eric Bolling is the host of Eric Bolling, The Balance on Newsmax. And Jeffrey Schwartz is a professor of criminal law and procedure at the Cooley Law School. And Jeffrey, we're going to start with you because this is a lot of law questions. You were a defense attorney, you were a prosecutor, you were a judge. So give us your sense of what we saw with the opening statements, the first witness. What does the prosecutors have to show in this case, and what do you expect from the defense?
Well, thank you for having me this evening. I believe that the prosecution clearly has to show that there were improper entries, false records within the Trump organization. They will have to show that the former president, in fact, had knowledge of all of that. That would be a misdemeanor. In order to make it a felony, they're going to have to show that it was done for the purpose of avoiding prosecution on other crimes that may have been committed, including FEC violations, that would be federal violations, which are other felonies. It doesn't have to be a New York felony. And also creating a fraud in trying to influence the outcome of the election in 2016. As far as Mr. Trump is concerned, he has to prove nothing. He can just sit there and listen and wait for whether the state has actually proven its case and beyond a reasonable doubt, and then he has the opportunity to present whatever defense he would like. He can testify if he wants to, I don't believe that he will. He says he's going to, but if I were his lawyer, I'd tell him not to. He faces some very difficult cross-examination. So it'll be interesting to see how each side plays what they want to impress the jury with.
And Jeff, all of us will be watching, but the most important viewers will be the 12 jurors. They're from Manhattan. We don't know a lot about them because the judge wants to cloak a lot of this in secrecy for good reason. No. We do know that there are 7 men, 5 women, including 2 attorneys. It's going to be a difficult task. There's a lot of pressure on this on these jurors. In fact, yes, some of the potential jurors were crumbling and crying, didn't want a part of this. Can you talk to us about the intense pressure they're under? And this can be several weeks of their lives committed to this.
They are under intense pressure. They do not want their friends and or the public generally to know who they are. They are aware that attitudes run very strong on both sides of this. They don't want to run into people on the street. They don't want people picketing them. They don't want their children being bullied in some way. They're very concerned for themselves. My hope is that that won't happen and that they'll be able to do their jobs, because generally jurors want to do their job. They want to do them well. And I have always been impressed with juries who set aside everything they think and only decide the case based upon the evidence that they hear in court.
And Jeff, one final question before we move on with some of these other issues that we want to talk about tonight. The gag order, where do you expect the judge to come down on this ruling?
Well, I think he's going to find that he violated the gag order. The question is, what kind of penalty could ever be assessed against Mr. Trump that in fact would be fair for what he did that would really hurt him in any way? Monetary fines really aren't going to bother him very much. $1,000 a violation, that's pocket change to Mr. Trump. So the question is how long the judge, Judge Merchant, will put up with all of this before he has to do something more severe, which I know he does not want to do. And as a judge, I had to do that to a lawyer once, get to the very edge before there was compliance with an order I gave him. But it's not something that judges like doing, putting people in jail for violations of orders and finding them in contempt. So I'm hoping it never gets that far.
Eric, of course, Donald Trump keeps calling this case a case of election interference. He made the statement again today as he was entering the courtroom. Let's listen to what he had to say.
This is done as election interference. Everybody knows it. I'm here instead of being able to be in Pennsylvania and Georgia and lots of other places campaigning. And it's very unfair. Fortunately, the poll numbers are very good. They've been going up because people understand what's going on. This is a witch hunt, and it's a shame. And it comes out of Washington. It's in coordination with Washington.
Eric, the case expected to go about 6 weeks. He's going to be in court all of that time. How is this going to impact his campaign and his efforts to fundraise, do you think?
I feel bad for Democrats. No matter what they've tried to do, it's working in reverse. I mean, NBC had a poll out today, and CNN had a poll out a couple of days ago showing that Trump in battleground states and swing states is beating Joe Biden across the board. It's not working because whether you like Donald Trump or not, whether you think he was wrong in paying for an NDA for Stormy Daniels and the other Playboy model, it doesn't matter. The legal system shouldn't be used against him. Let's not forget, and Jeffrey can weigh in on this, that the feds, the Department of Justice decided against going after Trump for the same things that Alvin Bragg is going after Trump for. Now, Alvin Bragg and Letitia James, both New York prosecutors and the AG, Letitia James, were elected on getting Trump. And the vast majority of the people who aren't in New York City realize that this is their way of silencing Trump, but it's not working. It's working in the opposite. People realize that you can't put someone on trial, take their money away from them, gag them, just simply because you don't like what they are and what they represent. And that feels like, to I think, most of the people, instead of running on the issue that they can really get Trump on, which would be abortion, the Democrats are running on Trump's a bad guy. Look at him in court, and it's not working.
Rena, he mentioned polls. There's another poll out there, Yahoo News, YouGov, which found an increasing share of independent voters believe this case involves a serious crime. 51% of all voters in the poll say that Trump should not be allowed to serve if he's convicted in this case. And that figure includes 16% from Republicans. Now, a lot of analysts say, you know, this guy's made out of Teflon. Nothing seems to stick. But could this damage him?
I certainly think a conviction in this case has the potential to really sideline him from this nomination. And I realize I'm speaking pretty far out here, and it's a lot of inside baseball for folks who don't know about brokered conventions. But any which poll you look at, you do see that a large faction of Americans do not want to see a president serve from behind bars. And there's nothing in our Constitution saying that he can't do that. But putting that aside for a moment, does he get convicted as a felon? Is this a misdemeanor? I'm certainly not the legal expert here, but what I want to say is this, is that there's a lot of talk inside the Beltway about really what's a playbook here. How does he use this case out of the four to his advantage if he's able to prevail? And that's the one place that I'm not sure there's a good answer. There seems to be only one page in his playbook so far, and it's that of victimhood, is to continually say that he is being vilified for no good reason. And I think if we're a country of laws, then we should let the legal system do what it's doing, which is put a private citizen in front of a jury of his or her peers and say, what do you think? And so we see that happening, and I think that's a good thing for our American representative democracy. I do want to say, I do think the former president, as a private citizen today and every day of the week for right now, for the foreseeable future, I do think he gets a bump and sort of wins every time he's able to draw into question the veracity of the charges that he faces. And that's the part we have to continually ask our fellow citizens, what do you think of that? Because there are a lot of people not watching this as closely as we all are.
But Rena, one of the things that he is experiencing right now, he's obviously in court, he's experienced a criminal case, but he's also experiencing a lag in fundraising, and so much of the funds that he does have are being siphoned off to pay legal fees. Talk to us about those dynamics, because that always plays a role in an election.
Well, this is quite unusual. We've just never seen the Republican National Committee used in this way. And it's now, you know, headed up. The co-chair over there is his daughter-in-law. They've got a unique mechanism through which they pay his legal bills. And look, they were already doing that under the previous chair, Ronna McDaniel. She said the RNC had paid, I think, something like $2 million-ish of his legal bills during her tenure there. But now every donation that comes in, even if it's small dollars, getting rerouted to his political action committee. So, you know, Republicans who stand by this former president and want to vote for him again this year say that this was the Democrats' plan all along, was to bury him in legal bills to keep him off the campaign trail. And it looks like it. But how much of a real impact is it going to have on what happens in November? I think the political winds are so uncertain this time that we can't make any predictions. But what we do know is that the money game is certainly not looking good for the Republicans, because down ballot Republicans need that money. And right now it's all going to Trump. Everything that seems to come in to the Republican National Committee that could be used to turn out voters again seems to all be going to help Trump world make it through these legal cases.
And Douglas, Rena makes a good point. We really don't know what's going to happen in November, but we do know this. The polls keep showing a very tight race. And Eric pointed out that the NBC poll shows Donald Trump ahead, leading Biden by a very thin margin, 46% to 44%. But when you dig into some of the answers, when they were asked which candidate was better at handling a crisis, has a strong record as a president, and is more competent and effective, the polling found that Donald Trump is the better candidate among many of the people polled. How concerning is this for Democrats?
I don't feel that it's too concerning at this stage in the game. We're in April. We're still several months off of a general election. I'm old enough to remember Mitt Romney leading Barack Obama in all the polls at this point back in 2012. There's a lot of time between now and November. Trump has a lot of courtrooms to visit. There are many people, many Republicans that are law and order Republicans that will simply not vote for someone that is a convicted felon. And let's not forget, we've seen this movie before. Back in 2020, Joe Biden beat Donald Trump. And I just don't see how Donald Trump will be able to win this coming election without adding moderate Democrats and independents to his vote count. And we know after what happened on January 6th, after four different indictments and 91 criminal charges and everything that's happened since then, that's just not going to happen. So, you know, regardless of what any polls are saying at this point, especially with how well Joe Biden is doing with the economy, we're just not worried on the Democratic side.
And Douglas, one thing that we are seeing, though, is this concern about young black voters who may not go to the polls this election year. At least that's what they're saying. We want to listen to some of what some black voters in Milwaukee, Wisconsin had to say. Let's listen to them, and I want to get your reaction on the other side.
Typically, I voted for Democrats. It's because my mom voted for Democrats, my grandma voted for the Democrats, just because of that lineage, that generational type of thing. If I did want to vote, if I were going to vote, as of right now, I'm not. It would be leaning more towards Trump, and I'm not even Republican.
I'm not going back to the polls because the polls, when we go vote for people, they lie to us. They tell us all kind of things they're going to do for us as a black community, and they do nothing. They do nothing.
I think the Democratic Party has not only taken the black vote for granted, they have disrespected the black vote.
Douglas, everybody's got their coalitions. This is obviously a very important constituency for the Democrats. How do they turn that narrative around?
Well, at this point, I think that's what it is exactly. It's just a narrative. I believe that when you see black people interviewed and saying they're not going to the polls or they're going to vote for Trump, those are outliers. Cornell Belcher's firm, Brilliant Corners, just did a poll of a significant number of black voters just in February, February 15th, February 20th, over 1,000 black likely voters and how they feel in this economy and how they feel about Donald Trump and how they're going to vote. First of all, 84% said that they were energized for the election. It showed that Trump's support among these black voters had slipped from 12% in 2020 to 8% now in 2024. And also when posed with the question of what is the single greatest threat to the black community, Trump being elected to presidency in 2024 was the number one concern. After that was white supremacy and white nationalism. After that was conservative Supreme Court taking away rights of black people, and then after that was crime, and then after that was the economy. So if we look at different polls, especially this poll was done by Cornell Belcher's firm, who was a black pollster, and the Black Pack, they come up with a very different story and a very different narrative. So again, that's not something I'm concerned about, seeing a big historical turn towards Donald Trump in this election by black voters. Trust and believe that will not happen.
Jeff, it's so interesting. Usually when you do politics shows, you spend a lot of time talking about polls. Today we're kind of gyrating from polls to courtrooms. Let's head back to the courtroom, because again, another big courtroom display this week. It's going to happen on Thursday. U.S. Supreme Court expected to hear oral arguments in the case of immunity. And this is where Donald Trump basically saying he has blanket immunity from criminal prosecution. An appeals court ruled against him, but this is a conservative court that's going to hear these arguments. What do you expect to hear on Thursday, and how quickly can the Supreme Court make a decision on this?
Well, what I expect to hear from Mr. Trump's lawyers and what I've read in their brief makes it very clear that they're arguing that a president has absolute immunity from anything they do wrong in or out of office. And their backup is, as long as what the president is doing is in the furtherance of his duties, he should have immunity, so he shouldn't have to answer for it and somehow be encumbered into doing his job. That does not seem to be anywhere in the Constitution. There have been presidents who have faced criminal charges. Richard Nixon was about 2 inches from getting indicted until Gerald Ford took him out of it by pardoning him. Nixon's attitude was basically he said, when the president does it, it's not illegal. That just is not so. A crime is a crime no matter when you commit it. Can he be tried while he's president? No. Can he be held responsible for what he does in office after he leaves office? The answer is yes. So the government's taking a position that there is, if you're a textualist, which most conservatives are, find something in the Constitution that tells me that that immunity exists, and I'll be more than happy to concede it. But I teach the Constitution, and I will tell you there is no such provision in the Constitution. The problem will be that there are three justices who will stall off this decision, and we probably won't see it till June 30th, which is the end of the court's term, in order to try to handicap any possibility of bringing him to trial in Washington on the charges that have been brought against him there. That's what I anticipate is going to happen.
All right, Eric, the word stall is also in the vernacular of the Trump defense team. It seems as though they've done delay. He is kind of destined for courtrooms, as Douglas said. Is that the playbook you see?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, why stop it in New York and go for Fulton County, where Fannie Willis is looking to do the same thing that Alvin Bragg is doing, and Jack Smith in the federal level? They're all trying to get Trump. But, you know, there's a great Jonathan Turley, a brilliant scholar, said that what they're doing in New York is they're trying to create new criminal law, new criminal code. Like Alvin Bragg, this is beyond the statute of limitations. The Department of Justice decided not to try Trump for the same things that Alvin Bragg is doing. And they're trying to make what Jeffrey clearly pointed out was originally a misdemeanor into some sort of felony charge. But to do so, you have to jump through hoops. You have to try him for something now for claiming that it had an effect prior to the election, yet the people prior to the election don't want to try him for that. The crime never occurred, in other words. So they're jumping through hoops to go get Trump, and it just, folks, it's just not going to work. I mean, if Democrats are smart, they'd let it go and focus in on the things, the real third rail to any GOP presidential contender, especially this time around, is abortion. The abortion topic is a loser for Trump. He can't win on that. But instead, everyone's focused, all the media's focused on his court dates. Douglas, can I just address your poll? You just defined outlier to a T. That poll you just talked about is the outlier. Morning Consult, some of the major pollsters show African Americans are going to vote for Trump as of right now, somewhere around 26%. That will blow the election to Trump in a heartbeat. So you can cite all you want, but don't call the Morning Consult and the other mainstream polls outliers. Your poll is the outlier.
Okay, Douglas, I'll give you a chance to respond quickly if you want.
Yeah, listen, this seems like a replay of a conversation I had with Adolfo Franco when he said, oh, there's going to be this huge red wave in 2022. We're going to slam the Senate. We're going to slam the House. It's going to be great. I said, no, I'm listening to Cornell Belter, Brilliant Corners. That's not what we're seeing. Early voter turnout, voter registration. It's not going to be a huge run. You're going to lose ground in the Senate, and you're barely going to get the House. Same firm, trust me on this one, as a Black Democratic strategist in a majority Black urban area and former Vice President of D.C. NAACP, I think I can speak on the Black electorate a little bit there.
All right, Rena, let me ask you about the House of Representatives, because this weekend they passed this appropriations bill that's going to send some aid, much-needed aid, to Ukraine and Israel. But it was not passed without some controversy. It's going to go to the Senate. They'll vote on it on Tuesday. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's kind of gotten sideways with his far-right delegation in the House. They're now talking about perhaps going after him like they did with Kevin McCarthy, Marjorie Taylor Greene, saying that he should be ousted. Give me your sense of whether or not you think that's really going to take place, and what's going to be unfolding over the next few days.
Well, we got to zoom out for a moment and realize how big it was that this vote actually took place and these bills passed the House on a weekend. I mean, the conversations in the House chamber were stalled for months. It felt like nothing could get done over there. And many people on the Beltway are saying this is the weekend that Speaker Johnson became Speaker. We have to remember, this is a man who's been in the job for like half a year. He's such a rookie, the almost unexpected Speaker, right? And here we see he had a serious dedication to legislating. In splitting up those three bills of foreign aid, I thought that was a really good tactical move. And then again, the fourth bill was about banning, but not a real ban, a divestiture for TikTok. And now it's on its way to the Senate. And I commend Speaker Johnson for not just doing the right thing, which I felt was a principled stance he took. He put his foot firmly in the camp of Reagan Republicans by saying, this is how America projects strength on the world stage, by coming to the aid of our allies who are
embattled. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for joining us. A great discussion. And that's going to do it for this edition of The Heat. I'm Mike Walter in Washington, D.C.